Hello and welcome to the Winston Marshall Show with me, Winston Marshall. I sat down with Andrew Doyle, one of Britain's leading journalists on the issues of trans rights, gender and gender-related topics. We discussed the Cass review. We went into great detail, a deep dive into Hilary Cass's report about gender services for children in Britain. We looked at the history of gender services in Britain. We looked at the media coverage. We looked at what this means, the implications, what it means for the future, what it means in the context of the past. We looked at the ideology behind it, the ideologies behind it, the concept of gender itself, all this and much more. Before you hear the episode, I ask, if you want to support the show, please press the subscribe button. If you press the subscribe button, I can have more great guests like Andrew Doyle discussing the issues that you want to talk about. But without further ado, Andrew Doyle. You're listening to The Winston Marshall Show with me, Winston Marshall. Andrew, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to talk about the Cass review, which you've written about, and you are one of the leading journalists on transgender and gender issues. You have been, to be honest, it doesn't take that much because it's a topic that's completely ignored by mainstream media, but you've been superb covering it on Free Speech Nation at GB News, not only that, and your Substack and various writings all over the place. So hopefully we can dig into the Cass review itself.
Yes, well, like you say, there's very few people that have actually covered this in any depth. So it's quite easy to excel in that field.
We laugh now, and it's actually quite a dark field.
It is.
Let's get into it. So Hilary Cass was appointed 4 years ago in 2020. She was appointed by a policy working group, which was established by the NHS England, and she was asked to chair the group because she was a clinician with no prior involvement or fixed views in the area.
Yes. Well, this has been years in the making. And of course, we've already had the interim Cass review, which came out a couple of years ago. And some of those ideas have already had ramifications, most specifically the idea of social transitioning not being a neutral act, which was something that was identified there. And that, of course, has influenced the government's guidance on on how schools ought to deal with transgenderism in schools. But yeah, this has been going on for a while. Now this final report has come out. It's going to have major ramifications.
So let's start with the report and the key aspects, the key things that jump out. What for you on your initial reading jumps out as the major issues?
There are a number of key findings in this review which should change the way that paediatric gender care is undertaken for good. And I think it will have a rippling effect globally. And I think really the UK is leading on this. I think the main takeaway from this very detailed and rigorous report is that on the whole, gender paediatric care is unevidenced. There is a complete lack of evidence. She describes it as being built on shaky foundations. That's the phrase that Cass uses. Now, I should emphasize that a lot of the findings in the Cass review, many of us have known about this for a long time. There aren't any new striking revelations. The big difference here is now you have a kind of official stamp on those, the things that we've been warning about for many, many years, which have largely been ignored. And I should say, the people who've stuck their neck out to warn about this stuff, people like Rosie Duffield at the Labour Party, people like Graham Linehan, people like Helen Joyce, Maya Forstater. I mean, the list is actually endless. I could sit here and rattle off a list of people for donkey's years. But the point is that all of those people who've been sounding the alarm have been written off as bigots.
J.K. Rowling.
I mean, yeah, so many people, particularly a lot of women, a lot of feminists. They've been written off as bigots, transphobes, fascists even, all of this sort of stuff. What this Cass review does, the final Cass review, is it vindicates all of those people. You know, I mean, we had, when Graham Linehan was on Newsnight a number of years ago, making the point that you don't tell children they're born in the wrong body because children will believe you, he was attacked. He hasn't worked for 6 years in the industry. Hannah Barnes was on Newsnight the other night saying pretty much the same thing, but it's all changed now. And I think it's really important that whereas a blame game isn't great, I think we need to be aware that there have been a lot of Cassandras in this area who haven't just been ignored, they've been demonized and monstered. And what is so wonderful about this review now is it's going to be very difficult for people to continue demonizing people in that way, monstering people in that way. They will, of course, do so.
Yeah. And they have begun to.
They already have begun to, yeah. I mean, because what we're dealing with here, I suppose, in a nutshell, and what the CAS review tells us, is we have institutionalized ideology. Mm-hmm. What we have is science. We have pseudoscience being promoted, a kind of quasi-religious belief system, which is directing the course of medical treatment, and that has been doing so for a number of years now, and that this has exposed it, confirmed it, and now something is going to be done about it. But don't expect the people who've invested in this and the people who promoted this to roll back on their position or to express regret or to admit that they made a mistake, because to do so would be to admit that they have been complicit in institutional gay conversion therapy and the medicalization and sterilization of children. That's a big ask for anyone to admit. I think it's much easier for them to continue down the road of ideology and denial, and we're going to see a lot of that.
I'll note that the tone itself of by Hilary Cass is a lot more conciliatory than your tone.
It has to be.
I'll just give a little overview of the Cass report, which I think a lot of people won't have the time to read. But it brings together, it assimilates a lot of work. So in some ways it has, so you mentioned Hannah Barnes, some of her work on documenting the 35-year history of JIDS that was closed down 2 weeks ago. Yes. It brings in some of that. It brings together all the different reports over time from the different organizations across the world. And it was brought together also with the University of York, who did a bunch of studies, new studies, and were also trying to assess as much detail as they could from the 9,000 children who have already been through the JIDS program in the UK.
That's so right. It's a consolidation effort.
Yeah. And in that sense, it's a really important piece of literature. If you're new to this topic, I think this is a great entry because you actually get everything. It's also got the science as we know it.
Yes.
And there's a lot of people debate the science, but actually she's very clear about what we know and what we do not know.
And the way in which she's gone about consolidating this is really key, because a lot of the trans activists are already criticizing it by saying a lot of evidence has been ditched, has not been looked into. But actually what's happened is CAS has set a sort of a standard of evidential threshold that is required. And therefore, you know, I mean, we can go into it, but I heard one activist talking about how really the lived experience of gender clinicians should have been brought into this. But of course, those are the very ideologues who have caused the problem, and lived experience isn't something that should be involved. This is all about data, it's all about science and following the science.
But Hilary Cass does bring in lived experience into the report, and she does cite Liz's lived experience, and she says that lived experience, quote, was brought in to help come to her conclusions.
But the key is that she's also predominantly relying on the science and the data, and saying that's where the NHS has been going wrong.
Let's start with a couple of the big myths, or the things I considered most shocking before going into it. The two big myths that I've heard again and again in trans ideology is, one is the born this way, as per the Lady Gaga song. In the CAS review, she doesn't completely discredit it, but she says it's actually very confusing. It's actually just as confusing as saying that there's no evidence that it's a social contagion. And actually she goes into the complications of, one, adverse childhood experiences, two, psychosocial factors, and three, differences in sex development, DSD, which is formerly known as intersex issues. So she makes it very complex. She really spells it out in that sense. And then the other big myth is the time to think, which comes back to the Dutch protocol from 1998, which is the idea that puberty blockers will give kids the chance to formulate their decisions, but actually you don't have time to think. There's psychosexual effects from puberty blockers. It affects your bone density, bone marrow, and there are other social problems related to the time to think fallacy.
And this is why Hannah Barnes' book was called Time to Think. And of course, that's absolutely right. The idea now, and what we can say from the CAS review, is that we now know that the idea that puberty blockers just provide a kind of pause where people can, you know, reflect on their feelings of gender, it's not borne out by the evidence. For a start, CAS makes clear that that the efficacy of these drugs has never been sufficiently evidenced. That's one thing. But also, we know that there have been side effects, and we know that there is increasing evidence that they are connected to osteoporosis, to paucity in brain development, to increased risk of cancer, to testicular atrophy, to all sorts of issues. And yet these drugs are being doled out like candy. So yeah, and of course, what we've always known is that the use of puberty blockers, you know, Mermaid still on its website says these are safe and reversible. But of course, in almost all cases, the use of puberty blockers, those patients go on to cross-sex hormones in almost all cases. And some of those go on to irreversible surgery. So this idea that it's just time to think, just to pause, is a fallacy, because what it really does is locks those individuals onto a pathway to permanent lifelong medicalization.
Is that pathway now been shut down? JIDS is closed. Is you know, the institutional pathway?
Yeah,
it seems like it's coming to an end. You know, kids still taking puberty blockers. It's not the same story anymore.
This is going to be very difficult to unpick. Yes, you're right that the NHS has banned puberty blockers. That's actually not very common. There's a couple of other countries that have done that. Sweden, I think, is one. There are a couple of other countries that have banned the use of puberty blockers, but most countries have not. In addition to that, there is the issue of private clinics. Private clinics in this country are not subject to the NHS ban, and they can continue to do this. Dr. Aidan Kelly was on, who is one of these private clinicians, was on Navarra Media the other day, saying precisely that, effectively advertising his own group, saying you can come to us and pay us a fee, and we will give you the drugs that the NHS now say are harmful. But we will do it for you. So, and you know, Liz Truss attempted to initiate a debate in Parliament about, among other things, about the use of the way in which private clinics are evading the loophole, or evading the ban. And what happened? Well, politicians from both the left and the right, Conservative and Labour, filibustered for 4 hours and spoke about ferrets to prevent a discussion going ahead about these important issues. This tells us how deep the ideological rot is. It's not just within the medical establishment. It's within the political class as well. There are all sorts of people who are completely invested in this. I have to say, not through malevolence. I think it's largely through ignorance. And I mean that in the literal meaning of the word ignorance, as in a lack of knowledge and a lack of understanding. I'm sure that those people who wanted to talk about ferrets for 4 hours thought that they were winning a great triumph for the plight of marginalized people. And they were doing the reverse. But because they don't fully understand the issues. You can see how deeply embedded it is from the Cass review itself, right? The fact that Cass has to use the language of the cult. She uses phrases like cisgender. Mm-hmm. She uses phrases like assigned at birth when she's talking about sex. She uses phrases like trans child. Mm-hmm. This is all from the lexicon of gender identity ideology. Now, maybe it's a strategic thing, as in you have to, but I don't think it is that calculated. I think all it is that this ideology has so completely captured all of our major institutions and political class that the only way we can now talk about it is through the language that they've set out. So it's going to be a huge problem to try and unpick all of this. And I think politicians are going to be the problem. I mean, we've had Wes Streeting from the Labour Party saying they're going to implement all of the recommendations of the Cass review. That's very positive. But, you know, we've had people like, is it Maggie Chapman from the Scottish Greens, who's saying, effectively, we're going to ignore it. She said, what was it? She said that the idea of not providing gender-affirming care until people are 25 is something she resists. Which just shows she hasn't read the review. That's not what the review recommends, for one thing. So she's misunderstood it. But you know, this is a person, Maggie Chapman is, you know, she criticised biology school textbooks for saying that sex is binary. She said that transition at the age of eight, as young as eight, should be permissible. This is someone who was bought into the ideology wholesale, and a hell of a lot of people have. So I think when we look at all of this, and when we look at the Cass review, we do have to really consider the way in which it is so deeply embedded. And like I say, internationally, we're actually bucking the trend by banning puberty blockers. So the fight is very much an uphill one. There's a hell of a long way to go. This isn't going to solve all of the problems. I think what we need to do is work around those who are ideologically captured at this point.
So I just want to push back against the idea that that Hilary Cass has taken on this language from the trans ideologues. The counter, I think, would be that she needs to make it inviting, and she needs to create the golden bridge for them to come on the journey with her. Because if she'd republished the report with, like, been hardline on language and not buckled at all on the language, it would immediately be just poo-pooed. Rather, organisations like Mermaids, Stonewall,
yes,
the Labour Party, and those who have been, you know, hard nailed and, yes, you know, hard pushers of the ideology are actually kind of entertaining the report.
But that's actually my point. Right. Like, I agree with you. Like, my point is that you have to build bridges. my point is that because it's so deeply embedded, you have to use that language to bring people along. Because the activists have been so successful at suggesting that anyone who raises a counter viewpoint is a bigot, unless you use that language, those dismissals can be easily applied. Similarly, so to give an example, so when Sarah Phillimore, who's a barrister, wrote an article for The Critic recently about a transgender judge, and she said at the start, I'm going to use the preferred pronouns of the transgender judge, not because I believe that this person is a woman, but because I'm trying to bring along people in the argument. Because otherwise, most normal people aren't going to read that article. They'll see that she's misgendering and think this is offensive and cast it aside. Now, I understand that Sex Matters, for instance, and LGB Alliance have put out statements saying that they're not approving of some of the language that the CAST review uses, but they also make clear that they understand why she has to use that language. So actually, I think we're all in agreement that I think strategically this is completely the right thing. But not just strategically, I think, like you say, there is a lack of understanding of what's going on here, and you will completely self-destruct the cause if you stubbornly say, no, I'm going to use the factually correct language at all state. I'm going to completely avoid the language of gender identity ideology. It just won't work. And the stakes are too high. You know, we're talking about kids ultimately being castrated. That means that we're dealing with it's too important to be proud about, you know, the language that we should use.
So much as the report is controversial, and I don't think it is controversial, but one of the things that I was completely shocked by is one of the recommendations was that any child given advice on gender issues should be told about the fertility problems that might occur. How was that not already being told them?
Because even when they have been told, they haven't been able to understand it. One of the big revelations of the WPATH files, which I know you spoke to Michael Schellenberger about, if people don't know, I suppose I should just quickly press you this. Yeah. The WPATH is the World Professional Association for Transgender Health. It's the leading global authority on gender, not just paediatric care, but gender care, full stop, which has a direct influence on the NHS, although the NHS, since the WPATH files, have tried to distance themselves from it. But huge influence. The leaked internal messages and videos from WPATH from leading clinicians who are giving advice to doctors shows that even those individuals who are meant to be experts know that they cannot, that the children and the vulnerable people who are suffering from schizophrenia and all sorts of conditions who are on these treatment paths cannot give informed consent to the treatment. The doctors know it. They're heard admitting it. One doctor talks about how, I'm talking to children about this stuff, but they haven't even done a high school course in biology. Children cannot understand the concept of lifelong sterility or a lack of sexual function because they're prepubescent and pre-sexual. Mm-hmm. These are not concepts mm-hmm. that they could even begin to understand. The fact that doctors have known that they cannot understand this, but they persisted with the treatment anyway, reveals something about the power of ideology. I mean, it sounds very like sort of just evil, pure evil, but it's not. It's people, probably a lot of good, well-intentioned people who are so caught up in ideological thinking that they do evil things. It's like Steven Weinberg, the professor, the physicist who famously said that, you know, in a normal world, you'd have good people doing good things and bad people doing bad things. But for good people to do bad things, it takes religion. You might substitute that word for ideology. Mm. And actually, in this case, absolutely right. I think these people are doing evil things, thinking that they are doing good things. So the fact that the WPATH files exploded all of this previously wasn't reported on by most of the mainstream media. But it also is the reason why a lot of us are already aware that this stuff is going on. And like you say, we are aware that children are being put onto pathways that they cannot possibly understand. They certainly don't understand the implications. Mm. One person yesterday, a detransitioner, someone who was transitioned and then later regretted it, tweeted out saying, look, if the recommendations of the CAST review had been implemented, if there had been follow-up consultations up to the age of 25, this individual says, I wouldn't have gone through, because this individual says that their feelings of gender dysphoria subsided at the age of 22. But what he also says is, it's too late for me because I've had my genitals amputated.
Is that from the 2022 CAST review or from the latest review?
This is yesterday, so this is from the latest review.
Okay, so I want to come back to the WPATH because there's more to unpack there, and there's more on the WPATH in the CAST review.
Well, CAST actually explicitly critiques WPATH.
The University of York appraisal of WPATH was that it lacked developmental rigor.
That's an understatement.
Yeah. one curious difference between this cast review and the WPATH is that WPATH got zero coverage in mainstream media, whereas this isn't everywhere, but it's getting a hell of a lot more. The cast review is getting a hell of a lot more.
Front cover of every paper.
Yeah. So why do you think the difference? Because it was... anyone who you've already explained the WPATH, but and anyone listening should listen to my interview with Michael Schellenberger. We take a deep dive into it, but that should be front page newspaper across the West. Like, it's unbelievable. It was horrific. Why is this getting a different look in?
I was genuinely shocked by the lack of coverage of WPATH. As you know, I did a 2-hour special on the WPATH files on Free Speech Nation.
You're one of the only people in Britain to do so.
Yeah, I think GB News was the only news outlet that even touched it, and the BBC didn't mention it at all. The only time it was mentioned was by Justin Webb on the Today programme, who's considered a bit of a renegade there, who mentioned it because he was going through the paper review of the next day and found a way to sneak in a reference to it. But remember that he was the one who was sanctioned by the BBC for mentioning the truth that trans women are men. So, you know, the BBC have, if you go to the BBC News website and search for WPATH files, nothing. It's been 2 months. I've emailed the BBC 5 times asking for why this omission? Why are they not covering this? And they've ignored every single one of my messages. That's to the press office. And they have replied to me in the past. It's not as though they think I'm beyond the pale. Look, the BBC has been completely complicit in the promotion of this ideology, including the promotion to children. There's a BBC video, a film aimed at kids, which you can see online, in which a woman is seen saying to a group of children, there are over 100 genders. The BBC has an identity unit, which effectively puts pressure on various elements of the BBC editorially to ensure that certain things are promoted. So there is a major problem there. I think it's a huge scandal that the BBC hasn't mentioned the WPATH files. I think everyone should have been talking about it. But in addition to that, to answer your question as to why Cass should get so much coverage when WPATH didn't, just largely, I think, a lack of understanding. I think to understand WPATH, we need to for a start, it's not UK-based. It's a US body.
Didn't get much coverage in the US either.
Well, there is that. Yeah, there is that. I think the truth is that so many, all of the major sort of media outlets and institutions are fully paid up to the ideology. And this is something that fundamentally cripples that ideology. So they have a vested interest not covering it. They believe the idea that gender-affirming care is the only possible approach and the only alternative is to be bigoted and transphobic. So, you know, once you've got that, the thing with the Cass review is that it's difficult for them. It's NHS. You know, it's closer to home. It's so rigorous. Not that the WPATH files weren't rigorous. I mean, the report that Mia Hughes wrote was very forensic. But I just think NHS is something they can't avoid, you know? Right. I think so.
So can we go back to this, sorry, to flick back and forth, but to the detransitioner you mentioned, they said that the new, if she'd, he or she, is it, I don't know, what's the name of, do we know the name of the detransitioner?
I don't, off the top of my head, I'm sorry.
They said that if the, if they'd given, followed this Cass review, they would have kept their health, they would have kept their fertility. Yeah. Can we talk about the recommendations from this review?
Yeah.
And let's back up a little bit. As we've already established, the JIDS was closed down 2 weeks ago after 35 years.
And that was after the interim Cass review.
That was after the 2022
interim Cass review. Because they found it to be unsafe for children.
Yeah, but there's still, we have private clinical practices across the country that aren't going to pay attention to this necessarily or don't have to pay attention to this.
And also regional centres for the treatment of gender dysphoria in children opening up to replace JIDS. But of course, there is a higher level of scrutiny. So the problem with JIDS and the problem with the JIDS at the Tavistock is that the scrutiny wasn't there. So you had effectively a kind of echo chamber of practitioners who were not subject to any outside viewpoint, which is why, we know that there was a private joke at the clinic that soon there would be no gay people left. We know from subsequent whistleblowers, going back to Susan Evans, David Bell, all of these people who said, you know, there is endemic homophobia at the Tavistock. There is not just from the staff, but also from parents who were uncomfortable with the fact that their child was same-sex attracted. We know from Hannah Barnes's book, Time to Think, that between 80 and 90% of adolescents referred to the Tavistock were same-sex attracted. In the Cass Review, she says 89% of girls were either homosexual or bisexual. 81%, I think she says, of boys, homosexual or bisexual. What we can see here is overwhelmingly gay kids are being heterosexualized and fixed to better accord with heteronormative paradigms. This is what they do in Iran. You know, it's illegal to be homosexual. They will kill you for being gay. So what the state does is subsidize sex change operations to fix you, to heterosexualize you. Pakistan did a similar thing for a while until they reversed that decision. It sounds alarmist and histrionic, but effectively you have a core group of NHS practitioners practicing gay conversion therapy on the NHS and pursuing... what we're paying for, pursuing an ideological line that mirrors the mullahs of Tehran. Yeah. It sounds like the stuff of fiction.
I just want to pick up on that detail because Hilary Cass coloured in a lot more on what is happening, the children that are coming in to the JIDs or have come into the JIDs, and there's the couple of the reports that they're happy to stand by. I'll just quickly like brush over them, but some of these interesting facts. Almost 50% reported data on depression or anxiety. 20% reported other mental health issues. That's of the patients. 41% of patients with functional tics had a gender minority identity. There's adverse childhood experiences. So this is, let's say, abuse and various things in the childhood of the children. But amongst the children, and some in a couple of these reports, or at least one of the reports, combined neglect or abuse, 11 to 67%, physical abuse, 15 to 20%, sexual abuse, 5 to 19%, emotional abuse, 14%, maternal mental illness or substance abuse, 53 to 49%, paternal mental illness or substance abuse, 38%, exposure to domestic violence, 23 to 25%, death or permanent hospitalization of parent, 8 to 19%, i.e. very high percentage of very troubled backgrounds that these kids are coming from.
This is really important to explore with a bit of care, I think. We also know that autistic individuals are hugely disproportionately overrepresented among referrals to gender pediatric care. You know, what is a very rare condition nationally seems to be very commonplace among these patients. In other words, what you've just outlined there, and you know, the Cass Review says it says one in five were either victims of sexual or physical abuse. Now, so in other words, there's all these other things going on in these children's lives. What gender-affirming care, what the gender-affirming model does is it says, if a child says, I'm in the wrong body, you just instantly believe and affirm that. And what you don't do is say, well, maybe it's to do with, maybe you're gay and you're struggling with that. Maybe you have a homophobic family. Maybe you're suffering from abuse. Maybe you're autistic. So all of these other avenues, which really, what this kind of thing requires is psychotherapeutic care and exploration and interrogation. And what instead you get is the affirming model, which is the very thing that WPATH says you ought to always do, just affirm, because it's too dangerous not to affirm. And they say that because if you don't affirm, the risk of suicide is high. We now know that's not true. Actually, suicide, it's very confusing. I mean, you know from the Cass Review, it's actually very ambiguous. There's no evidence about...
Well, some, they say that some reports say that there has increased and some that there's decreased.
That's the point. Yeah. So we don't have any consistency among the evidence base. So what we can't say is that suicidal ideation increases if you don't automatically affirm gender. That's something you cannot say as a matter of fact, but that's something that people have been saying as a kind of threat. In fact, activists have used the phrase to parents, you know, would you rather have a trans child or a dead child? It's a form of emotional blackmail, which is not backed up by the evidence, crucially. But look, it's really important that we understand this. All of the things you just outlined that Cass has mentioned, all of these various other possibilities that are going on in a child's life, a lot of clinicians have said that they are scared of exploring these various avenues because to do so leaves them open to the charge of practicing trans conversion therapy. In other words, of trying to change a child's innate gender identity. That, by the way, is the official policy of the Conservative Party and the Labour Party, which is that they both want to ban trans conversion therapy. What they effectively mean, or what the upshot of that would be, would be that clinicians could be at risk if they did try and explore all of these other aspects of a patient's experience. It would leave them open to prosecution.
Sorry, forgive me if I'm being slow, but by trans conversion therapy, because I understand to change trans is almost like a conversion therapy. So by trans conversion therapy, you mean converse...
It's complicated, right?
Yeah, what does that mean exactly?
It's really complicated because the phrase conversion therapy, we think of as meaning gay conversion therapy. You know, back in the day, they used to wire...
To un-gay them.
Yeah, they used to wire gay people up to electrodes. There was a guy called Dr. Galbraith Heath, I think his name was, in America, who wired electrodes into the brain of gay men, wrote a paper claiming that he had cured homosexuality through this method. They would wire electrodes up to men's penises, use aversion therapy. We think of that as conversion therapy. In lesbian terms, there's a lot of corrective rape, which still occurs. That's a form of gay conversion therapy. The bill... it still occurs in many countries. There's a New York Times report about this in talking about South Africa, I think, where it's still going on. Have a look at that because I'm getting the country wrong, but it's a really common thing in some countries. The idea of corrective rape, particularly from religious households. So the problem is that when the conversion therapy bill was passed, they lumped together gay conversion therapy with trans conversion therapy, and this completely confused the hell out of everyone.
What year was the conversion therapy?
It's only recent. It's only the last few years. I couldn't give you the exact year. It's been debated recently in the House of Lords, and then subsequently it was debated in the House of Commons. And you had the Conservative MP, Alicia Kearns, standing up saying why we absolutely need this ban on both gay and trans conversion therapy. The reason why lumping those two things together doesn't make sense is because a ban on trans conversion therapy is effectively mandating gay conversion therapy. Does this make sense? Because if you ban the explorative therapeutic practice of people trying to get to the bottom of why children feel confused about their gender, that is interpreted as you trying to change their innate gender identity. That is interpreted as trans conversion therapy. But actually what you're doing is it's taking mostly gay kids and fixing them and converting them. So this just shows how the linguistic minefields have created the conditions of confusion. Right. In order to be opposed to gay conversion therapy, you have to be opposed to a ban on trans conversion therapy. Try explaining that to your average person, because it doesn't make sense initially. It takes a lot of thought. So that's why when I say the CAST review isn't going to solve everything, there's too much to unpick. A lot of it is to do with language, and it's too deeply embedded. But I think one of the key things, one of the key findings is, and what might subsequently happen now is a return to the therapeutic approach as opposed to the gender affirming approach, because then you will be able to work out why children feel the way that they do. All of this is predicated on the notion that there is such a thing as gender identity, right? If you look at the Scottish draft bill that the government is putting through at the moment on conversion therapy, on their proposals for a ban of conversion therapy, the language uses the notion of gender identity, just presupposes that it is a thing, that it exists. At the same time, to deny that gender identity is a thing is also a belief protected in law since the Meyer for Starter case. How do they square that circle? On the one hand, you've got a government bill that's saying that gender identity is a thing and you have to accept it in law. And at the same time, we know that by law, you're allowed to not believe that it is a thing. This is very, very confusing. Now, I think the notion of gender identity needs to be scrutinized in a way that the CAST review hasn't done. I don't think we're there yet. I think that's the next stage, right? I think it lies at the heart of everything. Now, how do you describe gender identity? What is this thing? And I would put it to you that it is a metaphysical belief. And I would put it to you that we shouldn't be formulating medical practice on the basis of metaphysics. The idea is that we each have a gendered soul. Well, Helen Joyce in her book Trans describes it as something like a sexed soul. You might say that's an ungenerous way of putting it, but actually she has she's backed up by trans activists themselves. Julia Serrano, who's a trans activist, describes it as a subconscious sex. I interviewed the barrister Robin Moira White, a trans barrister and campaigner, on my show. I asked, what is gender identity? And the reply was, the essence of maleness or femaleness, or the essence of male or female, right? We're talking about souls. So activists themselves. Now, Judith Butler, by the way, who is the big high priestess, actually takes a completely different view. If you read Gender Trouble by Judith Butler, if you know about Butler's view of gender identity ideology, She doesn't believe in gender identity as a substantial thing, as a thing. She says that gender identity is an illusion that is produced by repeated performances, with performative kind of acts of gendered acts that are repeated and therefore reinforce the illusion of a gendered essence. So she actually thinks the opposite of what most trans activists believe. But most trans activists take this view that gender identity is effectively a kind of soul, even though they might not put it in those terms. Which is also why no trans activist, as far as I know, has satisfactorily defined the term gender identity.
And nor is there any science to support that.
And there's, of course not.
Anything close to.
But this is why those of us who have been talking about this for years were always going to be proven right. Because the only way that we would have been proven wrong is if scientifically it was discovered that there is a thing called a gender identity, a soul within you that may be misaligned to your body. Now, look, anything is possible. If it is the case, indeed, that that is a thing that we all have, that we do have a soul, that it can, a gendered soul, and it can be, the evidence can be discovered for it, I will change my mind immediately. But we know, don't we, that that is very, very unlikely to be discovered. So why are we? So I come back to this point because I think it's so important. We need to have a discussion about what does gender identity mean? And if it means what I am saying it means on the basis of what activists tell me they think it means, how can we possibly justify modifying the bodies of healthy children to better align with what is, after all, a spiritual concept?
One of the things that's so helpful to me about this CAS report is it brings together, like, all this whole field, this whole topic, this whole issue is, I think, sometimes deliberately nebulous, deliberately obscure and vague, and people can say, oh, well, this scientist, this scientist, the other. CAS, by bringing this all together, is very clear about how unclear the science is on it all, and how we don't actually know all those things.
Right.
It's quite, and just to see that written down is helpful.
Yeah.
On the topic of gender, just for clarity, and this is an argument I had with my girlfriend the other day. So I
don't want to get involved in that kind of domestic issue. But
I went so far to say gender doesn't exist at all.
Right.
Like even gender dysphoria is a misnomer. It should be sex dysphoria. Because you're either male or female.
Well, gender dysphoria is a phrase that was smuggled in by activist groups into the medical discourse. I mean, it didn't used to be called that. It used to be called gender identity disorder.
Yeah, exactly. Gender identity would be an important qualification for me.
Yeah.
So in that sense, but even gender, it's used so loosely that it's confusing, right. And we shouldn't be using it. I would say there's just sex. You're either male or female, and you either... But if you would say there... To what extent do you think gender is a thing?
What we can say is that there is a thing called masculinity and a thing called femininity. These are cultural products. The idea of expectations of how boys should behave and how girls should behave, which are not entirely untethered to biology, of course. You know, boys are far more predisposed to rough and tumble play than girls, and girls are far more predisposed to other forms of behavior. These things are observable and recordable and have been proven. So the idea of saying that masculinity and femininity are entirely cultural products isn't true. What is true is obviously the way in which we treat boys and girls. You dress girls in pink, you dress boys in blue. There's nothing innate about that. There's nothing that is fixed. That's something that we've just made up as a society. So gender, that odd term, I suppose, is a very complex relationship between biological factors and cultural factors. And that's something that is very interesting to explore and discuss. Why do boys in one culture and one part of history behave completely differently to boys in another part of history, in another culture? Well, that's because we are all partly products of our culture as well as products of our biology. Mm. And that's very interesting. And I don't think there's anything wrong with gender studies and discussing this stuff. I think where gender experts or academics have gone wrong is to veer into this supernatural belief that actually what gender is something that is built into you from the moment of conception, and is at once completely fixed to the extent that you have to have surgery to align with it, and at the same time totally fluid, and it can change from one day to the next. So I think absolutely a conversation about gender is fascinating, as long as you can move it away from the supernatural, I think would be the way.
We've got interrupted earlier on the question of where we are in the UK in terms of the infrastructure and how deeply this is penetrated into the infrastructure. I just wanted to quickly, it might have already been somewhat answered, but I and I'm setting this up so that I can understand what this review means moving forward, how things are different.
Yeah.
So as we have it, JIDS was closed down a couple of weeks ago. There are still private clinicians, as you mentioned, that are still practicing this stuff. And we've got, across the country, small clinics for gender clinics.
I should say very explicitly that Gender GP, which is one of these private clinics, put out a statement today or yesterday saying we are not going to respect the CAST review, saying we're going to carry on following WPATH's standards of care. Right now, the thing about that is WPATH standards of care, the current version is version 8, which is downloadable online. To give you some extent of the absurdity of WPATH's standards of care, you don't have to believe me, go and download it and look at the chapter on eunuchs. There's a chapter on eunuch identity in the WPATH version 8 standards of care, which urges medical professionals to carry out castrations on people who think they have an innate eunuch identity. Now, that sounds like I'm making that up. So go and check it for yourself. Not only that, NHS Scotland uploaded the draft version, which contained that chapter, on their official NHS website. So if you want to talk about the influence of WPATH on the NHS, it's right there. They subsequently pulled away from that. That draft version, by the way, linked to a eunuch fetish website, which included stories about the sexual abuse and sexual castration for sexual titillation of children. Now, that was on an official NHS website, ultimately. Now, it's really important that we understand that to cite WPATH standards of care as the sort of benchmark of global authority on transgender health, you're going to have to bring in all of that other dark stuff, which is right there. You know, if you want to check out more about this, look at Genevieve Gluck's work on this for Redux magazine. She's done a deep dive into the eunuch archives, which was the website which was linked in the original draft version of the standards of care. That website link was taken out in the subsequent version, but it was the draft version that went up on the NHS site. So, look, this is a deeply ideological body which posits that it positions itself as being an evidenced ultimate authority, which then trickles down across the board. I'm very conscious that as I even talk about this, it just sounds made up because it's too ridiculous to believe. And I also think that's why, but that's also why I don't think it's had much coverage. It's like the women in prisons thing. You know, now we know that men have been housed in women's prisons because they claim to be women. And now we know in some cases they've gone on to commit sexual assaults within those prisons. It sounds so ridiculous that a lot of people just didn't refuse to believe it, I think, for a long time. And it didn't get a lot of coverage as a result of that.
There's a famous example. Is, I think in a New Jersey prison, there was a transgender who was locked up in a woman's prison and he impregnated two of the other inmates. Right. I mean, it's like...
So who's going to believe that?
Exactly. It's so insane. Demi Minor, I think, was the name of the... Have I got that wrong? Maybe.
But even so, you're right. That, it's stranger than fiction. Yeah. And so that's another reason why...
Let's try and talk about something hopeful.
Yeah.
Although I've got more bleak things to come back to at the end. But just...
Sorry, this is depressing, Winston. I thought we could have a fun chat. But no, of course not. No, it's very serious and it's important.
Hilary Cass has recommended many recommendations all the way through the report, but one is a new model for gender services for children and young people, which doesn't sound too dissimilar from what you've already described. Do you understand this and how it's different from what's going on? And so the idea, again, regional centres with a national provider at the top of it.
Which has already been instigated since the closure of JIDS.
Exactly. Yeah. So does it really just seem like things aren't going to change?
Well, there's slightly more to it in Cass's... I mean, Cass's maybe also suggesting... No, Cass is also suggesting that there are follow-up consultations with individuals before the age of 25, which I think is really important. Not as Maggie Chapman claims that you can't have treatment before you're 25. It's talking about the fact that, you know, we know that people, the human adult brain is not fully developed to the age of 25. So, of course, you know, this would just be a standard duty of care, I think, you know. At the moment, we're in this awful situation where children... You know, the ban on puberty blockers is right there. But the second they turn 16, they can go to private clinics and not even private clinic, they're treated as adults. And they can immediately apply for cross-sex hormones at that point. So that is something that I think will have to be addressed going forward. Because those individuals are still vulnerable. Yeah. They're still young. They're still kids, let's be honest about it. And they don't need their parental consent to go and do that. In that sort of that window between 16 and 18, they can just go and do it themselves. In addition to that, you know, you've had activists effectively trying to... Now, activists have effectively tried to coach children to deceive doctors so they can go down this pathway. Cass herself has said this. She said it to the British Medical Journal. It's not in the Cass Review. But Hilary Cass has said, and she hasn't said who's done this, but she said that children have been coached on what to say. And specifically this, and this is really key. They've been coached not to tell GPs that they have been sexually abused or that they are same-sex attracted, right? The very things that might mislead them into thinking that they are misaligned in terms of their gender. The very things that actually the doctors need to know so they don't put them on this medication. They've been coached not to say.
Do you have any concept of where that's coming from? Is it online? Is it organisations?
So she said, she hasn't said who, which is very frustrating. Yeah. Maybe she has very good, I'm sure she has very good reasons for not saying who. Mm. Well, we know, I mean, look, I tell you what, Navarra Media published an article in December 2021 telling kids, or young people at least, how to lie to doctors to get the drugs. So there we go. I mean, they say something like, we don't suggest big fibs, but we suggest that you're economical with the truth and don't worry about it. You know, you just need to get your drugs. How irresponsible is that? Wow. But so we've seen evidence that that's already been happening. But from what Cass is saying, that's more widespread. What you've got to remember is you've got a lot of adults here who are invested in this ideologically because they believe that they have this gendered soul. And if there is such a thing as a trans child, if that thing is innate from childhood, it justifies their entire life experience. So I suppose they have an investment in doing this. And if that means getting kids to lie to get the drugs, then maybe they'll do it. I don't know where that tells us or where that takes us, but I think what it does do is it gives us a sense to which how far the activists will go. There was a leaked video recording from NHS, an NHS training session, which I played on my WPATH show on GB News, even though the NHS told us not to play it, but we thought it was in the public interest, where a doctor, a leading GP in the area of gender medicine, said that he wished that he who identifies as she wish that actually they could introduce these drugs sooner so that girls would go into the menopause before at the age of 12. Now that's a 50-year-old man saying that he wants to do that. That's what he would like in an ideal world. NHS GP, right? So again, the ideology is so blinding to these people that they're willing to sacrifice children on the altar of it.
Is the next step, you mentioned certain Labour Party politicians not uncleanly supporting the Cass Review, you know, they're typical caveats like about the culture war, whatever, but there's certainly a move, people like Wes Streeting, a move towards supporting this. Are we in the right direction to, in terms of policy at least, changing the rules and improving the rules for the safety of children?
I think one of the things we need to be able to do is to not demonise those who have been wrong. People like Lloyd and Russell Moyle from the Labour Party, people like Alicia Kearns from the Conservative Party, who I think just did not understand any of these issues. I think once we start saying, you guys are responsible for kids being castrated and they're never going to come around. We need parliamentary support on this. The Labour Party has made this commitment, which is great, to implement the findings of the Cass Review. I think the Tories have to be a bit more forthcoming about that and say that they're going to do exactly the same. And we need to be able to bring people along who are open to persuasion. And the only way we're going to do that, I think, is to work around the ideologues. The ideologues who would just never, you know, people like Owen Jones have already said he's not going to take the Cass Review seriously. You know, just work around those. Those people cannot be persuaded, so don't even try. But let's focus on the people who can be persuaded and the people in Parliament in particular who are going to be the ones who, who hopefully now will be up for listening. I mean, Rosie Duffield couldn't even go to her own Labour Party conference because she's been raising the alarm on this and she received so many threats. And Keir Starmer has refused to meet with her to even discuss it. Because so much of this has been down to the idea of no debate, because activists have said even to discuss the issues is a form of tyranny. They've been remarkably successful in confusing a lot of people. Well, now maybe with the Cass Review, it will blow open the idea of no debate. Maybe now, that's the first thing that's got to happen. The next thing that's got to happen, I think, is Stonewall needs to be driven out of public life. Stonewall needs to be completely...
So if Stonewall have again, they put out a statement about the Cass Review, which it's somewhat vague. They don't condemn it, but they don't particularly stand by it. They kind of they sort of loosely support and suggest that they're going to look more into it and come up with a...
Yeah, which you would think is good, but it's very weaselly, you know, partly because they're not being clear, but also because What they should do is they should put out a statement saying we've read and digested the cast review. We admit that we were wrong. We've behaved badly. We apologise. That would be really the ideal. But they're not going to do that. What we're going to get is we're going to get a lot of revisionism from a lot of people saying they never supported this to begin with, or they're going to shift the blame, or Stonewall has been above all groups, but Stonewall, Mermaids, Gendered Intelligence, LGBT Foundation, all of these groups have been instrumental in the promotion of this toxic ideology, this toxic belief system that has impacted children so detrimentally. And they now need to be completely not taken seriously anymore. Stonewall is now the biggest threat to gay rights in this country, but it dines out on its reputation as being a gay rights charity because it did do excellent things for gay people back in the day. But post 2015, it became an anti-gay rights charity.
That's when they added the T.
When they added the T, it became an anti-gay rights charity, even though they would not admit that. They would completely contest what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. But the upshot of everything that they've been promoting is against the interests of gay people. Mm-hmm. I mean, what could be more against the interests of gay people than having them sterilised? Stonewall has been losing support across the board for a few years now. Various government bodies have been pulling out of their diversity champions scheme, but they're still deeply embedded in the Scottish government, for instance, and they're deeply embedded in the corporate world. They need to now be completely driven out. There needs to be an investigation as to why they were allowed to take so much hold in the government, why they have had so much influence. Mermaids, similarly.
I mean, Mermaids have similarly put out their statements in response have been similarly loose, not condemning it, saying they'll look more into it. They welcome some of the language, but...
Under investigation by the Charity Commission anyway, and, because one of their trustees was found to be a paedophile apologist. They've also... they were found in leaked emails to have directly informed members of staff at the Tavistock in terms of the drafting of NHS policy. They claim...
That's interesting. So that would mean that they're lying at the moment because they're saying that they've never purported to be qualified enough to give medical advice.
Yeah, it's hilarious, isn't it? It's like when Stonewall recently added to their website, we do not give legal advice. They've been misrepresenting the Equality Act 2010 for years to all the various corporations that they go and talk to. This was found by the lawyer Aqua Reindorf, who said that they've been representing the law as they would like it to be, not how it is. But of course, they backtrack and then they add these little caveats to the website. And the Mermaids say they're not medical experts. We don't give medical advice, Yes, you do. Yes, you have. Mermaids has been caught advising kids how to get breast binders without their parental consent. So, they can't be taken seriously. Remember that Mermaids, by the way, and if you want some evidence for how quickly this ideology has taken hold, just look at a document by Mermaids from 2000. Lauren Stoner, the CEO of Mermaids, was on Sky News yesterday talking about how, we've been standing up for the rights of trans
people. Laura Stoner, yeah.
Laura Stoner, saying we've been standing up for the rights of trans people for 30 years. But what she's not telling you is that they used to give very sensible advice. They used to give this very kind of watchful waiting approach that most sensible people are now advocating. There's a leaflet from the year 2000 which Mermaids published saying, look, if your child is struggling with issues of gender, they're most likely gay. They're going to grow out of it. Don't worry. That's what they used to say. They don't say that anymore. And in the past few years, they've basically taken this hardline ideological stance, and they have given medical advice in spite of their denials, and they have been influential, and they've been culturally influential. Even Starbucks were selling cookies to raise money for them. So I think now these bodies who have so much clout and so much power on the basis of ideology and a supernatural belief in gender identity, they now have to be marginalized, driven out. They should not be involved in any decision-making when it comes to policy. I'm not saying they shouldn't be allowed to exist or to express their point of view. I'm a free speech absolutist. I think if you believe in a gendered soul, by all means, scream it from the rooftops. More than happy for you to do that. I think I'm a liberal. I think anyone should be able to identify as they like, call themselves whatever they like, dress however they like, do whatever they want to their bodies. It's up to you. But we're talking here about children. That's the red line for me. Children cannot consent to this stuff. Even the doctors at WPATH know that children cannot consent to this stuff. They just do it anyway. So we have to do something about it, something that there needs to be a concerted cross-party effort to stop the influence of the likes of Stonewall, to investigate it, to see if there needs to be criminal procedures in some cases. Something has to be done that is more than let's just pretend that we never supported it all along, which I fear is going to be the approach by many people.
You mentioned Navarra Media earlier, and there's a couple of media responses I want to look at. But Navarra Media journalist there, Michael Walker, I think I watched the same video as you. Curiously, he did a whole hour on the cast review, although
it wasn't quite an hour.
The video is titled "The Controversial Cast Review," although he also admitted several times he hadn't read the cast review in the interview. But he said, and he seemed to play down the idea that there'd only been something like 1,000 children who'd taken puberty blockers, so this really isn't a big deal.
Yeah, that's incredible, isn't it? I mean, I think, look, like I say, you know, given that Navarra Media has been partly complicit in the publication of that article in December 2021, it doesn't surprise me that they would want to be sceptical about the cast review and that they wouldn't want to accept its findings. He interviewed two different people. Both of them were trans activist doctors. One of them was Dr. Aidan Kelly.
You mentioned him earlier.
Who is from a private gender clinic, which is very ideological in nature.
How many private gender clinics are there in the country?
That's a good question. I don't know is the answer to that. But he, if you watch his interview, and I don't want to misrepresent him, so please watch it yourself. But what he says is, not only is evidence about this stuff unattainable, it's not even desirable. So he's saying we should be able to continue on instinct and intuition alone. Why should we have evidence? You know, he says, yeah, you know, sure, the gold standard of healthcare is to get evidence before you proceed, but actually it's not possible, so let's just carry on. It is quite an incredible interview with no pushback from Michael Walker at all, because of course my assumption is he believes it, he supports it. I mean, he says he's skeptical about it because of the numbers. He says, well, you know, 1,000 kids put onto puberty blockers in 10 years is what, 100 a year roughly. He says, well, that's negligible. It's not negligible if you're the child who ends up suffering from osteoporosis, loss of sexual function. That is not negligible. If it's how many, I would like to ask Michael is how many castrated people would be acceptable for you? How many kids with osteoporosis and poor brain development? What's acceptable? What's acceptable collateral for your religious belief system? What's acceptable? Because if 1,000 is just not worthy of your consideration, then I want to know that figure.
I hate to change the topic too much, but I can't help but think when you're speaking of the grooming gangs, and you know you have tens of thousands of girls have been abused, and in the name of political correctness, whether it's the police, whether it's the politicians, whether it's the media, it's kind of ignored. Oh yeah, it's just like it's not a big thing, and it seems to me it's almost like a similar thing. And maybe the only thing in common is that it's political correctness. Maybe it's politically. Yeah.
And I think a lot of people, you know, people like James O'Brien now talking about how, you know, there's been too much toxicity in the debate. And
he said that the only thing we can take away from the cast review, I won't get his exact quote right, which is basically the only people who are vindicated are those of us who detoxified the whole conversation.
Hilariously. I mean, the idea that James O'Brien detoxifies he's a major culture warrior who always toxifies the debate. You know, that's insane. That's like saying, I don't know, that Vlad the Impaler is a pioneer for truth and reconciliation or diplomacy. It's hilarious for him to say that. But of course, it's the absolute denial of the truth, which they need to do psychologically, I suppose, unless it's a bit more calculating than that. But look, no, of course, the grooming gangs is a good comparison. You know, those who raised the alarm were accused of being racist. The police admitted that they didn't investigate properly because they didn't want to be accused of racism. Now you're going to have people saying that, oh, people like Rosie Duffield and Helen Joyce, etc., toxified the debate. They didn't toxify the debate. They raised the issues. It was really, really important, you know. And even those who, you know, ended up being so frustrated that they started using language that was intemperate, well, I don't blame them. Frankly, when you're getting a brick wall of silence and you're being told you're a fascist for raising the points, those responsible for the toxification of this debate are those who refuse to listen and refuse to speak, such as James O'Brien.
And now they're not even reading the cast review.
No, why bother? They already know what they think.
Yeah, we haven't talked about, you talk about these people have been called fascists, and we haven't even talked about the impingement of on women's rights and how women in all of this have been completely, you know, their safe spaces are gone, their freedoms have been completely torn at. And someone like Posy Parker is constantly called a fascist. And I hope that she sees some vindication in this, although this is obviously specifically about children.
Absolutely. And also, of course, well, yes, but girls are overwhelmingly impacted by this, I should say, as well. So, for instance, you know, if you go back a number of years to the early days of the Tavistock, and they had a handful of patients, and they were mostly boys. Now it's increased, what, sort of by 5,000% or something ridiculous, an extreme amount. That figure's wrong, but you know what I mean. It's amplified hugely, and it's mostly girls. And there's a lot of girls now who are identifying out of femalehood. You know, I've spoken to feminists who make this point that as a girl, you know, your body's changing, you're getting male sexual attention, which you don't want. There's a lot of girls who are identifying as either non-binary or trans. I know that the Cass Review is a bit sniffy about the idea of social contagion, but I think there is overwhelming evidence that teenage girls have a propensity towards social contagion, and this is a new kind of social contagion. It does affect girls a great deal, but also more broadly, the entire notion of this pediatric gender care has been driven by gender identity ideology, which is an ideology that harms women above all, because it seeks to erode women's single-sex spaces, because it says that anyone who claims to be a woman is a woman, that the notion of being a woman is a kind of ethereal decision that you make, an identity category, in other words, rather than a biological category. So, yes, I focused on the gay rights issue because I know more about that and I feel more well-placed to talk about it. But absolutely, of course, the feminist issue is paramount.
Maybe a small detail, but the social contagion aspect that you mentioned there, it does come up very, very briefly in the report. But again, almost poo-pooed.
Well, I think it's partly because the remit of the review isn't schools, and the remit of the review isn't...
But I would say I think it's an important part of this aspect, because what Hilary Cass does show is the change in demographic of people who are identifying, and it went from being more male and older to young women, predominantly young women. And that change, I think, and this ties in a lot with Jonathan Haidt's work and his latest book about the effect of social media and like the like button and the retweet button. And there is a correlation that this is happening, this contagion is happening at the same time. And I don't think that's a coincidence.
No, it probably isn't. I mean, I would need, obviously...
But that's for another...
You can't assume. It probably needs to be looked into, but surely the explosion of social media has something to do with it. There's a lot of activists on TikTok basically telling kids you're in the wrong body. You know, don't trust your parents, you know. It is good that although the Cass Review doesn't cover, you know, it doesn't want to go too far in terms of advice to schools and stuff. But you know, Cass did make the point that it's not neutral to socially transition a child. And by socially transition, I mean... refer to a child with the opposite sex pronouns and a new name, that what that effectively does is it locks children in psychologically to that pathway. So in other words, teachers who are not medical, they're not qualified medically, are actually contributing to something that could end up going very, very seriously wrong. So they might think that they're... I mean, I know teachers who've done this. I know a teacher who told me, you know, his school said to him, look, just use the names and the pronouns that the kid wants, but lie to the parents. When you do the report to the parents, use the original name. Teachers shouldn't be put into that position. But what they now need to realise is that by using those pronouns, you think you're being kind, you think you're just affirming people's identity, you could be doing them actual physical harm. So that needs to stop. And what I'm hoping is that in the schools report that will subsequently come, I know it's in a draft form at the moment, that the guidance will say schools should not participate in the social transitioning of children, and parents need to be aware at all times. I think that's going to be really, really important.
Yeah, very important. Although, having said that, I'm not particularly, I was more optimistic coming into this conversation.
Oh, really?
Talking to you, because it seems like there's still, the ideology is so deep that there's a lot of work to do. There's one particular example, I can't go through this interview without bringing up this specific detail from the Cass report. Deep in Appendix 4, Table 1, pages 7 to 9, there is a list of reasons why adult gender identity clinics did not participate in the data linkage and did not contribute to this, and it included concerns about funder motivation and political interference. The unintended outcome of the study is likely to be a high-profile national report that will be misinterpreted, misrepresented, or actively used to harm patients and disrupt the work of practitioners across the gender dysphoria pathway. So there's still infantry, there's still, you know,
I mean,
doubling
in other words,
down, and there's real fight back still in the medical world, in the NHS.
Isn't that shocking? That's something that the report mentions, that there was resistance to giving up the information. I was quite heartened today that there was an article which I briefly saw from the government are saying now to these NHS trusts, you have to give up the data.
The Health Secretary, Victoria.
Right. What I say about the embedded nature of the ideology, what they knew is that if their ideology is open to scrutiny, like the CAS review, it falls apart. Yeah. They know that. Yeah. They knew that this was the child pointing at the emperor and saying it's got no clothes. Yeah. And they didn't want that to happen. So they didn't cooperate. The lack of cooperation in of itself is very, very revealing. And we need the adults back in the room, right? If you want to be one of those ideologues who isn't going to cooperate, then just get out of the picture. You know, we need to work around those people. Like I say, you'll never convince them. You know, they're, you know, it's like telling someone their God doesn't exist. A true believer is never going to believe you. And they're going to take your denial as evidence that he does. So there's absolutely no point. But what I'm saying is, because the majority of people don't believe in this, don't share this metaphysical view of the world, they don't believe in the gender identity, we can still unpick a lot of the damage. And I didn't mean to depress you, but the truth is, there is such a long way to go, and nothing is guaranteed. There's no way to guarantee. You know, look, the US government, the Biden administration, is completely on board with this ideology. Around the world, most global medical institutions are still relying on WPATH. They're ignoring the revelations of the WPATH files. Activists within these communities will always say that these things are misrepresented. You've already had activists trying to debunk the CAS review. And the way they debunk it is actually just to call anyone a bigot who takes it seriously. Mm-hmm. People are terrified of being called a bigot and transphobic and hateful and all the rest of it. It's a very effective strategy. What I'm hoping now is that we get some backbone among politicians who are willing to take the slings and arrows of all of that, are willing to be smeared and lied about. Because this is too important. It's more important than individual ego and individual reputation. There's a bigger thing at stake.
That leads me into my last question, which I hope you don't mind me asking a personal question. You're one of the people that have been smeared as bigot and fascist and all these the kind of cheesy, classic nonsense names and phrases. And you have been absolutely persistent and continuing on this story and, you know, shining a light on it when very, very, very few journalists, not only in Britain but in the world, are doing it. The level of detail that you've followed this on, you're really shining a light on this, what I consider monstrous incident in British history. And I wondered what was the motivation, like how do you have this energy to keep pursuing it?
Because I don't like lies. I never felt like it was a choice insofar as I can't go along with a lie if I know it's a lie. So I think it's just something that I would always naturally do. Anyway, I've always been like that. I'm committed to liberal values. I'm committed to free speech and inquiry. And I don't think it was a choice. I can't imagine a situation where I would say, okay, I'm just going to keep my head down about this, you know. I mean, there were too many people getting hurt as well. This is why I say I don't think a lot of it is down to malevolence. I think a lot of the people who haven't spoken out just haven't really looked into it and haven't really understood it. I think that's the only way I've got to believe that, I suppose, if I'm going to retain any faith in humanity. I think that's the truth. For whatever reason, when I was reading about this and learning more about this, you know, I think I could see through a lot of it, and I was trying to express my view on this. Because I don't know what the alternative is. The alternative is just not saying anything, and then I'd have to live with that. And I think living with that would be harder than having all the insults and having all the smears and the libel and all the rest of it. Like, yeah, that's all horrible, and the pile-ons are horrible, and the misrepresentations. You know, all of my views are out there for anyone who cares to read them. You know, I've written two books in which I outline completely my worldview, and it is a fully liberal, progressive worldview,
free speech, and the new Puritans.
But of course, most people don't read what I actually write or listen to what I actually say. They concoct a kind of straw man, a folk devil to attack. And however upsetting that can be, and it can be, particularly when it gets very abusive, and particularly when libelous statements are made about me, that is still preferable to knowing I could have said something and not saying it. And I think a lot of people feel that way. I think, you know, there have been a lot of people in this fight who have put a lot more on the line than I have, you know, and who have received a lot more in the way of threats and bile than I have. And I think I can't speak for them, but I think it comes out to a matter of principle, doesn't it? I mean, even someone like J.K. Rowling, she didn't have to do this. You know, like, you could say, well, she's a billionaire, she's protected, but she gets death threats and rape threats every day. That's not pleasant for anyone. I don't care how rich you are. And but the fact that she did it is, I think, so admirable. She actually made that choice that she didn't have to make because it's about principle. I think a lot of people are just, they follow their principles. I'd say most people, I think, follow their principles. And I include in that the gender ideologues. I think they sincerely believe what they're doing is right. I think most people are good faith actors. And I mean, there's a lot of people who aren't in this debate, but I think for the most part, people are. So I think that's all it comes down to is just, it was a choice between telling the truth and going along with something I knew to be false. And I would have found on a personal level harder to live with.
Well, on that note, Andrew, wonderful speaking to you. Thank you so much for this deep dive and all the best of your continued work on this and all the other topics and all your other projects. I hear, I've been following your Substack. I recommend that to viewers. I recommend your books. And I heard you mention you might be writing on your secret Substack podcast for subscribed listeners only.
Yeah.
You're writing a book on liberalism.
I am, yeah.
That's for hopefully for our next conversation.
Well, there's a lot to talk about there, isn't there? Yeah, but that's my next project, yeah.
Very exciting. Andrew Doyle, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Winston Marshall Show with me, Winston Marshall. If you enjoyed that episode, I humbly ask that you like, share, and subscribe. But otherwise, stay tuned. There'll be more coming soon.